He should have had no way to see me tucked safely behind glass in the dark kitchen. I dumped the rest of the water out of the glass and set it quietly in the sink. My shoes were still in the mudroom where I'd left them. I slipped them on and walked out to talk with Coyote. 10. Gary Laughing Dog said that I should try to be interesting if I wanted to see you, I told Coyote as soon as I was reasonably close to the SUV. Coyote laughed. That one has been trying to avoid me for most of his life. His white T-shirt set off his long black braid, tied with a pink scrunchie. Maybe if you didn't get him sent to prison when you visited, he'd be more interested in seeing you, I suggested, trying not to stare at the scrunchie. It had a white lamb dangling from a chain, and I was pretty sure he'd worn it just for me. I didn't reach up to touch the lamb on the necklace around my neck. Gary needs his life shaken up, Coyote told me. Then he belched with more sound and fury than a 13-year-old boy with a room full of girls to impress. If you get me or mine sent to prison, I'll hunt you down, I told him seriously. He grinned at me and half-slid, half-scrambled down the back of the SUV to end up standing on his own feet. He left the bottle on the vehicle's roof. He began moving off down the driveway at a brisk walk. When I didn't immediately follow, he turned around and began walking backward and waving his hands for me to join him. His braid swung around when he did, the little lamb flapping with his movements. I was not going to say anything about the stupid lamb, if only because I was certain he wanted me to say something about the stupid lamb. Come, come, he said. Come take a walk with me. If I hadn't needed a favor from him, I might have stayed behind. But I did, and I wasn't opposed to some exercise to get rid of the miasma of fear and despair my nightmare had left me with. Our feet crunched on the dry dirt and gravel. I don't understand why you are so determined to hang around with werewolves. They are all about rules. And you, he slanted a laughing glance at me, like me, are all about breaking them. There was something about walking down a deserted road in the dark that made for thoughtful silences, especially when the deserted road was too long, too unfamiliar, and even at this hour of the night, too deserted. Coyote probably had something to do with that. Finally, I said, I don't know about that. The werewolves' rules are all designed to keep people safe. Safe. He tested the word. Safe. His nose wrinkled. Who wants to be safe? I haven't noticed you running to safety. I bit my tongue. I liked being safe. Being in Adam's arms was safe. Talking to Coyote was anything but. And where was I? I supposed he had a point. Safe is good, I told him. Not all the time, no. Sometimes, though, it is better than water in the desert. He made a rude noise. I thought more about rules and werewolves. I glanced over my shoulder, but I couldn't see Honey's house, or any other house, for that matter. Coyote was definitely doing something. I hoped that Adam went right back to sleep and hadn't heard me open the back door. He'd be worried. Rules keep the people I love safe, I said, thinking about Adam. It is important to me that they are safe. He nodded like I had said something smart. Then he said, And when rules don't keep them safe, we break the rules. I could agree with that, and almost did. If it weren't for that little bit of smugness on his face, I would have. I wonder what rules he was contemplating breaking. Admit it, he said when I didn't say anything more. Admit it. Keeping all the rules is boring. Tell me you don't want to short-cheek Christie's bed, or put Ipecac syrup in some of that too delicious food she is always cooking. I'm not childish, I told him, and I'm not petty. No. He agreed sadly. More's the pity. And how do you know how good her food is? He just smiled and kept walking. I took a deep breath. Time to ask him about the walking stick. I'd given it to him as a gift, and he'd taken it as a favor. I wasn't sure how he'd react when I asked for it back. There he is, Coyote said, sounding delighted, and he broke into a sprint, the stupid lamb bouncing with his stride. I ran as fast as I could, but Coyote stayed ahead of me. I couldn't see who it was, but I wasn't surprised when, after a minute or two, the path turned, and there was Gary Laughing Dog sitting in the middle of the road with his back to us. I stopped beside him, but Coyote had walked around so Gary couldn't avoid looking at him.
I hate you, Gary said with feeling.
He threw a small rock and nailed a T-post on the side of the road. He picked up another, tossed it into the air, and caught it on the way back down. Coyote threw his head back and laughed.
I wondered how much longer you'd stay locked up in the gray box. You didn't used to let them hold you for so long. Knowing I was safe from you there, Gary said, throwing the rock in his hand with barely controlled violence, I planned on staying inside as long as I could. My conscience drove me out before then.
Conscience, mused Coyote. They looked alike, he and Gary Laughing Dog.
I wonder where you got that.
Quit tormenting him, I said sternly. Gary twisted half around to look at me.
Go tell the sun not to rise.
He stood up and dusted off the back of his jeans.
Looks like you got too interesting, Mercy. But did you have to let him include me?
I have a gift for you both, said Coyote grandly. Come along, children. He started off down the road.
We might as well, said Gary in the voice of experience. If we don't, something horrible will come out of the night and chase us. We'll end up dead or doing exactly what he wanted anyway. Cooperation saves all of us a lot of trouble.
Coyote snickered. What? Gary said, sounding aggravated. Coyote turned around and walked backward. He held up a hand.
You?
He held up another hand as far from the first as he could.
Cooperation.
Gary sneered at him. Coyote sneered back, and I saw that Coyote's eyes and Gary's were the same shape. Then the moment was over, and Coyote turned around and faced the way he was going. Gary started to follow, but I stepped in front of him and stopped, shaking my head. I waited until Coyote was far enough ahead of us so we could talk in relative privacy before starting down the road. Relative, because I was certain Coyote could still hear us. He wasn't that far ahead.
Why aren't you asleep? I asked Gary.
Because I'm a fugitive from the law and there was a lawyer sleeping in the same room with me, he said with feeling.
Kyle wouldn't have turned you in.
Gary shook his head.
Eventually, he'll realize who I am, and if he doesn't want to lose his license to practice, he'll have to turn me in.
We walked a little while, and he said,
I don't really want to get any of you in trouble for harboring an escaped prisoner. I've done what I needed to do, told you what I knew, and it is time to make myself scarce. It isn't the first time I've been on the run from the law.
He looked down at his feet, then gave me a rueful smile.
Though most of the time I've deserved it more. I can head over to one of the Montana reservations and they'll let me stay until the state of Washington decides it isn't so concerned with some idiot held on a nonviolent crime. If I'd walked while on parole, they might not even look for me. Once the fire dies down, I'll get a fake ID and show up somewhere else as someone else. About time to do that anyway.
All that was true earlier when you said you'd spend the night, I said. He looked at me. Then away.
One of your wolves saw me looking at Honey and told me about her husband. That's who she's got following her around, right? She's not going to be able to see anyone else until she lets him go.
I'd had the thought that it was Honey's fault that Peter Shade was still hanging around, too.
Probably not, no, I agreed. He died not very long ago.
She's interested in me, he said.
He flashed me that grin again, but I saw behind it. To how alone he was.
I'm not just being vain, though I own that as well. But it hurts her that she's interested, and I think she's been hurt enough. It was time for me to leave.
Coyote began whistling a song that sounded suspiciously like London Bridge is Falling Down.
Screw you and the horse you rode in on, Gary yelled, and Coyote laughed.
To me, Gary said,
So I'll leave. I'll become someone else and maybe stop by in a few years.
He didn't mean that last sentence, I could tell, and he knew it. So the lie was for himself, and not me.
Fingerprints, I said. DNA? Facial recognition software? Hard to lose yourself in this day and age.
That had been the main reason that the werewolves had finally come out to the public.
He raised an eyebrow.
You mean you don't know how to fix those?
Then he shrugged, gestured with his chin toward Coyote.
He taught me a trick or two. He can teach you, too. Gary Laughing Dog is no more. I'll pick a different name and be someone else.
Sounds lonely, I said.
He shrugged again. I saw a beer can that looked like one I'd passed earlier. I kicked it gently and sent it rolling to the side of the road.
If you'd gotten me up, I could have taken you to the bus station and bought you a ticket.
Hitchhiking is safer.
He looked at Coyote.
Usually, if Honey didn't live out in the middle of freaking nowhere, I had to go looking for a less rural area that might have someone who'd pick up a hitchhiker.
Coyote briefly interrupted his whistling to say,
Or a car to hotwire.
Gary clenched his jaw.
Or a car to hotwire, he agreed.
The clenched jaw told me it bothered him to steal a car, and that he'd have done it, if necessary. Oddly, both of them made me like him a little more. I've done some hard things in the name of necessity.
If I had started earlier or not had to walk so far, maybe I could have just gotten a ride instead of walking the same half mile over and over again until I finally realized that the reason the road looked the same wasn't just because around here a lot of roads look the same. I probably hiked 2 hours before I noticed. I have a little experience with odd happenings. Mostly it means that matters are out of my control. Again. So I sat down and waited for Coyote to show up.
Sympathy didn't seem the right response, so I just kept walking. Eventually, the stiffness left his shoulders, and he seemed to mellow a bit.
He asked me, Did you get a chance to ask him about the Fey artifact you need from him?
No, I said.
Shh, said Coyote, trotting back to us. Time to be quiet now. This way. Come with me.
He stepped off the road, into the darkness. We climbed a little hill. A hill I hadn't noticed until Coyote took us off the road. It was, like most uninhabited places around the Tri-Cities, covered with rock and sagebrush. We crested the hill, then followed a trail down a steep gorge. At the bottom of the drop, a thicket of brush grew, the kind that occasionally flourishes around water seeps that are sometimes at the center of ravines around here. The brush covered the faint trail we'd been following. Coyote dropped to his hands and knees to crawl through. After a deep breath, as if he planned on diving underwater instead of under a bunch of leaves, Gary did the same. I followed. The soil under my knees was softer than I expected. No rocks, no roots, no marsh, nothing with stickers. Not that I was complaining. But if I hadn't already known Coyote was manipulating the landscape, the lack of nasty plant life would have proved it. There were no signs of any other people or animals, despite the way this trail looked like some kind of thoroughfare for coyotes or raccoons. A high-pitched wailing cry broke the silence of the night and sent unexpected, formless terror through my bones, leaving me crouching motionless under the cover of bushes, like a rabbit hiding from a fox. The first howl was answered by another. I wasn't the only one who froze. Gary had stopped, too. Coyote sat down and turned to face us.
His children break the night with their hungry cries, Coyote said. That we hear them in this, my own land, means that they have hunted this night, and there are more people on their way to the other side. Dead, said Gary. You mean Guayota has killed more people?
Coyote nodded, as solemn as I'd ever seen him.
You need to understand this, both of you. Once Guayota took the first death, he can never stop. He will kill and kill and, like the Wendigo, never be free of the terrible hunger, because death never can satisfy that kind of need. He cannot stop himself, so he needs to be stopped.
He lifted his head and closed his eyes.
They are quiet now. We need to keep going.
The pitch of the trail changed to an uphill climb, gradually getting steeper and steeper, until I was scrabbling up a cliff face. I could no longer see Coyote or Gary, and I hoped they were still ahead. I dug in my fingernails and shoe edges and hauled myself up. Sweat gathered where sweat generally gathers and rolled in jolly, salt-carrying joy all across the burns I'd acquired fighting Guayota. Eventually, I chinned up over the edge of the cliff and rolled onto a lawn. In front of me was a hedge, and under the hedge were Coyote and Gary lying side by side. There was space between them, and I elbow-crawled forward until I was even with them, but still under the hedge. Beyond the hedge was a manicured lawn, just like the one I'd crawled over. That cliff edge had been a barrier between Coyote's lands and the real world. I hadn't noticed the transition on the way out here, but now, lying beneath the hedge, my senses were crawling with information that hadn't been available, the sounds of night insects and the scents of early spring flowers. Coyote's road had looked and smelled exactly as I expected, but real life doesn't do that. Real life is full of surprises, big and small. I'd keep that in mind the next time Coyote showed up. That we were out of Coyote's place meant that the hedge we lay under was real, as was the yard and the house it surrounded. The back of the house was lit by bright lights. I saw the silhouettes of trees and bushes. Between us and the house was a kidney-shaped pool encased in a walkway of cement. In the night, with the house light shining in my eyes, the water looked like black ink. The house was a high-end house, not rich-rich, but nothing that a mechanic's salary would have touched. Maybe there were some distinguishing features on the front of the house, like an address. But from my viewpoint, the house looked like any of 100 other expensive houses. The deck, jutting out 15 or 20 feet from the house and 3 feet off the ground, was the most interesting feature. That, and the dogs. The two dogs were chained at opposite ends of the deck, each chewing on rawhide bones as long as my calf. At least I hoped they were rawhide bones. Coyote shoved something in my hand. I didn't have to look down to know that I held the walking stick, but I did anyway. It looked much as it had the last time I'd seen it. A 4-foot-long oak staff made of twisty wood, with a gray finish and a ring of silver on the bottom. The silver cap that sometimes became a spearhead was covered with Celtic designs. It looked like something I could have bought at the local Renaissance fair for a couple of $100. The last time I'd held it, I had felt its thirst for blood, and its magic had thrummed in my bones. Now the wood was cool under my fingers, and it might as well have been something I bought at Walmart for all the magic I sensed. "It knows how to hide itself better," Coyote murmured, sounding like a proud parent. I watched the dogs, but they didn't seem to hear him as he continued talking. "I taught it a few tricks and gave it an education. It helped me out of a few jams." I was going to have to return the walking stick to Lou's son and tell him that Coyote had taught it a few things. Why did I think that might not go over too well? "Do you remember what the walking stick's original magic was?" asked Coyote. "Make sheep have twins," I told him. The dogs didn't react to my voice either. "And?" "That was it," I told him. "Lou made 3 walking sticks. This one makes twin lambs. One of them helps you find your way home, and the third allows you to see people as they really are." "Hmm," said Coyote. "Are you sure your source was reliable?" "Yes," I told him. "I think," said Coyote, "that you should recheck your source. Maybe there were 3 staves that all did the same thing, or maybe there was only ever one. Or maybe," he gave me a sly look, "I was just able to teach it to ape its brethren. I suppose it doesn't really matter. Look at the dogs." I tightened my grip on the walking stick and looked. "It's hard to see anything with those stupid lights," I complained. Coyote gave me a look, then glanced at Gary. "Okay, but look fast." I frowned at him, and Gary sighed, rose to his knees. In his hands he rolled 2 small rocks, like the ones he'd been playing with when Coyote and I had first come upon him. He He lobbed them one right after the other and took out the big lights. Both dogs surged to their feet, glanced at the lights, then right where the three of us crouched.
"Gary," said Coyote conversationally as he turned around and raised his butt in the air until he was crouched like a runner in a sprint at the Olympics, "you should stay until the end of this story. Sometimes the end of the adventure is much better than the beginning. Besides, you might be more useful than you know if you stick around."
Gary answered something, but I'd finally remembered that I was supposed to be looking at the dogs. Under my hand, the staff warmed, and I realized it was happy to be back with me. Then I looked, really looked at the dogs, and the walking stick's affection and Gary's and Coyote's voices were abruptly secondary. The dog nearest me was female. I could see her form inside the dog's body, sort of wrapped in the flesh of the larger animal. She had a woman's body, naked, and made more disturbing by a head that was a smaller version of the dog's. She had dog's paws from her ankle on down. She crouched on all fours. Binding magic wrapped her from head to paw in a shimmering pinkish fabric. Since joining the pack, I was getting pretty good at spotting those. Pack bonds were part of my daily life, and what held her was a magic very similar, but not the same. If the pack bond was spider silk woven into a chain, this was a mandarin's robe used as a straitjacket. That was not all I saw, though, because my seeing of her was not limited to what I could sense with my eyes. Age. She was so old, this dog. Older than the structures around her by millennia or more. Her eyes glistened red in the night and focused on us. She opened her mouth, displaying sharp teeth that were too many and too long to fit in her mouth. She barked at us, the noise bigger than it should have been, and with an odd whistling sound to it that made me want to cover my ears. It wasn't that unearthly and terrifying sound that Coyote had said was a Tibisenas, but it was something akin to it. Everything about the Tibisena was bigger, more powerful than the lines of the body she presented to the real world. The other dog was Hoel. If the woman's binding magic was a robe, his were silk ties. They wrapped securely around him, but did not envelop him completely. They weren't part of him yet. Like the female, he saw us too. The dog's body that encompassed him was poised on the deck, watching us, but silently. While the dog was motionless, Hoel was not. He pulled and tugged at the bindings, peeling them back and leaving gaping wounds that bled behind. As soon as he cleared one place and started on another, the bindings grew back. I wondered how old the man I'd killed when I shot Juan Flores's dog had been. Coyote leaned forward and whispered into my ear, "When it looks like a mortal creature, the mortal flesh encompasses the Tibisena and may be killed as any mortal creature. When it is wrapped in the Tibisena's form, it cannot be harmed by mundane means." And when he said the word Tibisena, the head of the walking stick sharpened into the blade of a spear. My eyesight sharpened, too, and I saw that there was a third layer I had not been able to distinguish before. Surrounding each dog was a shadow that grew more solid as my hand clenched tighter on Lou's walking stick. A shadow that was large and hairy with red eyes, as in the story Kyle had told. Huge, polar bear huge. 4 or 5 times as big as any werewolf I'd ever seen. Gradually, the other, smaller forms disappeared inside the giant dogs, both of whom were looking directly at me. Coyote slipped back, grabbed my ankle, and dragged me backward out from under the hedge like I was a rabbit he'd caught. He dropped my ankle, grabbed my elbow, and hauled me to my feet. Before I could catch my balance, he all but threw me down the cliff face we'd come up. I managed to stay on my feet, using the bottoms of my shoes like skis and leaning my weight back on the walking stick for balance in a mockery of glissading. As a kid, glissading down steep, snow-covered mountain slopes had been an upgrade in difficulty and fun to simply sledding. Fun wasn't a term I applied to glissading down a cliff that had no snow for padding in case of accident, and using an ancient artifact that might break, and wasn't that a lovely thought? I had a pretty good idea about what would happen when an old Fey artifact was destroyed. At least the spearhead had returned to its more usual form, so I wasn't likely to stab myself with it, too. I didn't fall until I was almost at the bottom. So when I rolled, I hit that improbably soft ground and emerged not much worse for wear. Gary landed on his feet beside me, and on the other side, Coyote grabbed my arm, exactly where he'd grabbed me before so I was sure to have bruises, and hauled me to my feet again.
"Run," he said.
Gary grabbed my hand and pelted down the path, pulling me in his wake. The path still had its cover of greenery, but now the ceiling of leaf and stem was tall enough for us to stand upright in. As soon as I was running all out, Gary dropped my hand. I tucked the walking stick under my free arm, put my head down, and ran as the howls of the dog became baying and a second dog joined in the chorus. Hoel had evidently lost his battle for control, and Coyote's trick with the landscape didn't stop the dogs from hunting us in it. Speaking of Coyote, I glanced over my shoulder in time to see that a four-footed coyote had stopped in the middle of the path behind us. He was a little bigger than the usual coyote, but if I'd seen him out my window, I wouldn't have given him a second look. He gave me a grin and a wag of his tail before running the other way.
"Stupid, stupid, stupid," Gary chanted as he ran. "Stupid freaking coyote, always getting me in trouble."
I bumped him with my shoulder. "Accept some responsibility for your own life," I panted finally. "You could have stayed sitting in the middle of the road. You chose to come with us." Gary gave me an irritated look.
"Whose side are you on, anyway?"
He wasn't as out of breath as I was. Maybe he had more practice running.
"I didn't know there was a side to be on," I grunted.
I could still hear the dogs. No, not dogs. I thought of the giant forms, the ones that Coyote said could not be harmed by mundane means. These were Guayota's children. They were Tibisanas.
"They sound like they're getting closer," Gary said.
I wished he hadn't, because I'd been thinking the same thing.
"I thought Coyote was going to divert them."
My voice was breathy because I didn't have much air to spare.
"Right," said Gary, "just like he diverted the police when I ended up in jail. I think we're the intended diversion here."
"He dumped me in a river where there was a monster killing things," I told him.
"There you go. That's a coyote I know and hate."
The woods and brush thinned, and we were running on the hill down to the gravel road we'd traveled before.
"Which way?" said Gary.
I looked frantically, but there was nothing to distinguish one direction from another. Although the moon had been in the sky when we ducked into the tunnel of brush, there was no sign of her now. I felt down the pack bonds and the bond I shared with Adam. Though I could tell they were somewhere, I got no sense of where they were in relation to me. The connection was foggy, as if they were a lot farther away than an hour's walk.
"You pick," I said as we hit the bottom of the hill, and he jerked my hand and pulled me to the right.
I made the mistake of looking up the hill and caught sight of one of the Tibisanas cresting the top, the female. She saw us and bayed twice before plunging down the hillside after us. I quit looking back and concentrated on running, and on hoping that she didn't give that cry we'd heard before, the one that had frozen me in my tracks.
"Isn't that walking stick supposed to take you home?" Gary asked. "Why don't you say the magic words? There's no place like home. There's no place like home."
Where did he get enough breath to be sarcastic? If he wasn't being sarcastic, then he didn't know Fey artifacts as well as I did.
"They aren't Dorothy's ruby slippers," I said. "Fey artifacts have a mind of their own, and this one is particularly contrary."
I turned my head to glance at him, and I noticed that there was a house in the distance, the first house I'd seen all night.
"Look, Gare!"
I ran full tilt into something solid planted right in front of me. I lost my balance, and my feet skidded sideways to tangle with Gary's. Everyone fell, tumbling and rolling on a gravel driveway because Gary and I had been running really fast. And the solid thing hadn't been a tree like I thought. It had been Adam.
"Hi,"
I said, panting, sprawled out on top of my husband, who'd done the chivalrous thing and taken the brunt of the fall.
"A funny thing happened when I went to get a glass of water."
He smelled so good, warm and safe, and Adam. Coyote had dumped Gary and me right in front of Honey's house, at the exact spot where my husband stood, had been standing, until I hit him running full out when he wasn't expecting an attack from the ether. Still lying flat on his back, Adam looked over at the walking stick that had missed clocking him in the head by an inch, maybe less. Coyote hadn't fixed the walking stick entirely, or possibly at all, because I got the distinct impression that the walking stick had tried to hurt Adam, but hadn't quite managed it. I tightened my hand on the old wood, and the impression faded until it was only a stick in my hand. The effect Adam had on me was such that it was only then I remembered that I should be afraid. I lifted my head and listened as hard as I could, but I couldn't hear them. "Are they still following us?" I asked urgently.
"We're not dead," said Gary, who hadn't moved from his prone position on the ground. "I'd guess that we lost them when we got dumped back here. It's too much to say that we're safe, not when himself is about, but safe for now." "I take it you met with Coyote?" Adam said politely as he sat up, so I was sitting on him instead of lying on him, and glanced at Gary. "Both of you?"
Gary got up and started pulling goathead thorns out of his arm.
"I hate Coyote," he said without aiming the remark at anyone.
I ignored Gary and answered Adam. "Was it the walking stick that gave it away?" I asked with mock interest that would have worked better if I weren't still trying to catch my breath. My heart was beating so hard that the force of my pulse almost hurt.
"No, I figured it out earlier when your scent trail disappeared into nothing, mostly. The walking stick just meant my suspicions were correct."
Adam closed his fingers on my shoulder, not quite hard enough to hurt.
"Don't do that again," he said. "My heart can't take it."
"I didn't intend to do it the first time," I half whined. I would have all the way whined, but it was suddenly too difficult to whine. Why was it that I could run and run, but a minute or so after I stopped, I couldn't breathe anymore? I could happily have stayed safe in Adam's arms all night if it weren't for the fact that I was covered with sweat, and I had to straighten and give my diaphragm a fighting chance to force my lungs to start working properly. I stood up, and Adam's hand loosened, sliding from my shoulder to my arm, until he had my hand. "I'll certainly try not to wander off with Coyote again without your knowing about it, but try is all I've got," I told Adam when I had control of my breath again. He looked up at me. There was heat in his gaze. There was always some spark of heat when Adam looks at me, but there was also need that was deeper than sexual. I could see the shadow caused by worry, possessiveness, and a vulnerability that allowed him, the alpha wolf, to stay on the ground when I was standing. That vulnerability, and the possessiveness, meant that Adam would never let me leave him, as he'd let Christy leave him. I didn't like him vulnerable to anything, even to me. I pulled on Adam's hand, and he stood up. "I love you too," I told him, and he smiled, because he'd let me see what he felt. I cleared my throat. "I think Coyote was trying to help." Gary made a derogatory noise. When I looked at him, he was staring down the road. He didn't trust in his safety, even when the danger couldn't be heard or scented. I wondered if he wanted to be safe, or if he was more like Coyote. Like me, he was covered with sweat, but he seemed to be breathing better than I was. He must have stayed in good shape while he was in prison.
"Where did Coyote take you?" Adam asked.
He had kept my hand. "Let's go find some place to sit down," I said. I needed a shower more than I needed to sleep, and I needed to sleep, now that the adrenaline charge was dying down, like a bee needed flowers. Honey had a picnic table in her backyard. Sitting on the table, Gary and I took turns telling Adam what had happened. I don't know why Gary sat on the table, but I was still so jumpy that I didn't want a chance trapping my legs if we had to run again. Adam paced. I envied his energy. He hadn't been chasing after Coyote all night. Before we'd gotten very far in our narrative, Daryl, then Mary Jo, joined us. Mary Jo gave me a full glass of water. I drank half of it, and dumped the other half over my head to rinse away the sweat that was still dripping into my eyes with stinging force. The water helped my eyes, but not my cheek.
"You can turn into a coyote between one breath and the next," said Mary Jo when I got to the bit about running from the Tibisenas. "I've seen you do it. You are faster that way, so why didn't you change when the Tibisenas were chasing you?"
"Clothes," said Gary. "You try changing when you're wearing your clothes, and the next thing you know, you're tangled up in your jeans."
"At least you don't have a bra," I agreed sourly.
"While you were out running around, you got an interesting phone call," Adam told me, pulling my cell phone out of his back pocket.
He hit a button.
"Wolf wants to talk to you."
I put it up to my ear. If he'd said that last before he'd hit the button, I'd have objected. Jumpy and exhausted are not a good state for talking to Wolf, Marsilia's right-hand vampire. The last time I'd seen him, he'd been trying to kill me and Marsilia, the vampire who ruled all the vamps in the Tri-Cities. There was an outside chance that Wolf had actually been trying to protect Marsilia, but I had no trouble assigning him as much villainy as seemed to want to cling to him, and a bit more.
"Mercy?"
Wolf's voice was enough to wake me right up. "You wanted to talk to me?" I wished I had more of Mary Jo's glass of water left.
"Mercy," he whispered. "Mercy. I can still taste you in my mouth."
I pulled the phone away from my ear because I didn't want his voice that close to me.
"I long for your blood on my tongue, little coyote girl."
Creepy. Of all the creepy people and monsters I've encountered, and a lot of monsters are pretty creepy, Wolf is the one who gets to me the worst. I think it's because he scares me the most. I had been thinking about drinking, and he started talking about it, as though he was reading my mind. He does that kind of thing a lot. He knows it bothers me, and that just encourages him. "And I can see you turning to dust in the middle of the afternoon under the hot summer sun," I told him, trying to sound bored. I did a pretty good job. Exhaustion and boredom sound a lot alike. "If your dream comes true, then mine gets to come true, too."
"Life is not so fair, Mercy," he said,
and someone in the same room with him made a noise. Any adult who has ever watched a porn flick knows that noise. It's the one that real people don't make unless they are faking something. "If you just call to flirt, I'm hanging up." He drew in a shaky breath, then moaned. I hung up.
"Who was that, and why was he having phone sex with you?" asked Gary. "I need to wash my brain," muttered Daryl. "Next time I see that vampire, I'm gonna squish him like a bug."
"I feel violated," I said, half seriously. The phone rang, and I set it on the table. It rang again, and we all looked at it. Adam picked it up and hit the green button on the screen.
"Mercy, you spoil all my fun," Wolf said, sounding less psychotic and more petulant. "You keep killing my playmates. It's only fair that you take their place."
I don't know which playmates he was talking about. Andre? Frost? Frost was the last vampire I'd killed.
"No,"
said Adam, as if Wolf had been asking a question.
"I told you I'll only talk to Mercy," said Wolf, dropping into sing-song. "I know something you don't know."
"What?" asked Adam.
"I have news about a man who was looking for a house this week with room for his dogs. He paid cash. Lots of cash."
"Where?"
asked Adam.
"Oh, dear," Wolf said. "You don't think I'm going to tell you, do you? I could have told you an hour ago."
Adam looked at me. I took the phone. Coyote said that Guayota and his dogs had killed again tonight. This wasn't just about Christie anymore. Guayota needed to be stopped. "It's me," I said. "But if you keep screwing with us, I'll call Stefan and see if he can't figure out what your news is." Marsilia, the mistress of the local vampire seethe, was courting Stefan with as much delicacy as a Victorian gentleman courted his chosen lady. He'd been her most loyal follower for centuries, and she'd broken the ties between them with brutal thoroughness in order to maintain control of her seethe. Now that he was finally talking to her again, If he asked her for information, she'd give it to him, even if it was for me. There was a little silence on the line. Then Wolf said, sounding hurt, which was absurd, "I have no reason to help you, Mercy. One of my sheep brought me some interesting-for-you information, but if you aren't going to be nice, you don't get it." Vampires. "Nice how?" I asked. "Come to my house tonight," he purred. "You remember where it is, right? I'll give you my information if you play well enough."
"She isn't going alone," said Adam.
"Oh, no," agreed Wolf. "Nothing says fun like an alpha werewolf. Just you two, though."
I was going to be a zombie for the meeting with the lawyer and the cops tomorrow. Adam would have to do all the talking for me. He'd had about 10 minutes more sleep than I had. But if Wolf knew something, anything that would give us an advantage over Guayota, we needed to find out what it was. In less than a week, he'd killed who knows how many people. The official report, according to Adam's private investigator in Eugene, was that 4 had died in the fire Guayota had started in Christie's condo. There were all those women in the field in Finley, and however many he'd killed tonight. Coyote had said Guayota wouldn't stop until he was stopped. "Fine," I said. "Give me time to shower and we'll be there." I hung up my phone and looked at the time. "When's daylight?" I asked.
"About 3 hours," Adam said. "About a half hour before we're scheduled to meet with the lawyer."
"I could take Warren or Daryl," I said. "You could sleep and go meet with the lawyers. I'd join you later for the police and keep my mouth shut. Possibly drool on your shoulder and snore." He shook his head.
"No, I'll drool and snore on you, too. The one thing that is not going to happen is you visiting the court jester of the evil undead alone."
11. Wolf's house was in a housing development that had been an orchard 10 years ago. The houses in this one almost escaped that we were all designed by the same architect and you can pick one of 3 house plans, sameness. It had been in place long enough for hedges and greenery, but not quite long enough for big trees. The neighborhood was firmly middle class, with mobile basketball hoops in front of the garage doors and driveways and swing sets in the backyards. The people who lived right next door to Wolf had a giant cedar kids' activity center. It was way too huge to be merely a swing set, and an above-ground swimming pool in their side yard. The side yard right next to Wolf's house. Those hadn't been there the last time I'd visited. Wolf's neighbors had a yappy little dog that started barking as soon as we pulled into Wolf's driveway. No lights turned on, and I bet that it yapped at cars driving by, cats trespassing in its yard, and bugs flying past the window. There is nothing more useless than a watchdog that barks at normal things the same way it does at a thief at the door.
"This is where Wolf's home is?" asked Adam, turning off the engine.
"I know," I told him. "Blew my mind, too." He looked at the swimming pool.
"I feel as though I need to warn them about what occupies the house next door."
"If it helps," I said, "they are probably the safest people in the Tri-Cities. He's not going to feed so close to home. And you can bet that nothing else is, either, unless their yappy dog drives Wolf crazy. Then all bets are off." Adam shook his head and hopped out of the SUV. I jumped out of my side, too. I couldn't see the ghosts. Vampires' lairs always have ghosts, but they only show up when the vampires are asleep. I could feel them like a dozen eyes watching me from the shadows. I met Adam in front of the house and let him approach and knock on the door while I kept an eye out behind us for an ambush. The man who opened the door had a line of big hickeys on his neck and wore nothing but a pair of jeans. When Adam wore nothing but his jeans, it was sexy. This guy was just disturbing. He wasn't fat, but there was no muscle on him, just loose skin and softness where muscle should be, as though someone had siphoned all the muscle out and left him dying. His eyes were dead already. He didn't really look at us. All of his attention was focused behind him, even though his eyes were on us.
"My master says you are to follow me," he told us.
We entered the house. Though it looked spotlessly clean, the interior of the house smelled. I remembered that from the first time I had visited here, but it was worse than I remembered, as if I'd filtered some of it out in my memories. My nose caught the charnel house odors of blood, meat, feces, urine, and that odd smell of internal organs. Faintly but pervasively, I could smell an underlying scent of something rotting. Adam took point, and I followed, watching behind us as I had on the porch. Wolf's sheep led us into the kitchen, where we were treated to the sight of Wolf lying down on top of one of those 1950s chrome and green formica kitchen tables. There were three chairs that matched the table. Two of them were knocked over, and the third was tucked in where it belonged on the side of the table where Wolf's head was. Like the guy who was ushering us into the house, Wolf was naked from the waist up. Wolf had been about 15 when he was made a vampire, old enough to hint at the man he would never become. His ribs showed, and his skin was almost powder white, a shade paler than his hair. Last time I'd seen Wolf, his hair had been buzzed, but it was longer now, maybe half an inch long, and it had been shaped. He lay face up, back slightly arched and eyes closed. One foot, wearing a purple Converse tennis shoe, was flat on the table, pushing his knee up. The other leg was outstretched, that foot bare and pointed, like a ballet dancer's. He painted his toenails green, and they matched the color of the formica tabletop. I didn't know if that was on purpose or not. The light over the dining room table was on, and someone had put daylight bulbs in the fixture because the tabletop looked more like an operating table than a place people might sit down and eat breakfast.
"Wolf," Adam said dryly, "it's what's for dinner."
"Yes," Wolf said, suddenly sitting cross-legged and facing us. "See, Brian? I told you he would get it."
"Actually, you said she would get it, Master," the man who'd let us in said.
Wolf looked at him thoughtfully.
"Am I still allowing you opinions?"
The man blinked at him.
"How long have you belonged to me, Brian?"
Brian had been the name of my foster father. There were lots of people named Brian. It shouldn't bother me so much that they shared a name. This man who was a victim of a vampire and my foster father.
2 days?
Brian sounded unsure.
"That's right," said Wolf. "I let you think until the third night." "What happens on the third night, Brian?"
Brian's heartbeat picked up. For a moment I thought it was fear, but then I caught the scent of arousal.
"You drink me dry?"
he said in the same breathless voice that six-year-olds talk about Christmas.
"Go away, Brian," Wolf told him. "Go sleep until tomorrow."
"Tomorrow," Brian agreed, and hurried eagerly past Adam and me. After a moment, I heard a bedroom door slam.
"You feel sorry for him," Wolf accused me.
"You intended me to feel sorry for him," I assured him. "Mission successful. What do you want in exchange for the address?" I couldn't rescue the vampire's victims without starting a war, and it was too late for this Brian anyway. If I were sure that war would confine itself to Marsilia's seed and our pack, I might try it. But my connection to Bran and Marsilia's to the Lord of Night who ruled vampires the way Bran ruled the werewolves held the danger of escalation. If there was a war between werewolves and vampires, everyone would lose. Still, if one of their victims ever asked for help. Wolf lowered his eyes as if he were a little shy.
"I want a drink, Mercy. Just a little sip."
"No,"
said Adam, and the word was echoed by another no. Stefan's voice in my head. I'd let Stefan bind me to him once, because another vampire had been feeding from me, and I didn't want to belong to that one. Belonging to any vampire was bad. All anyone had to do was look at Wolf's victim, his Brian, to understand that. Belonging to a vampire the other vampires called the monster would have been worse than bad. So I'd asked Stefan for help, and he tried. But Stefan's hold had been broken when the monster had taken me again. When he died, all of the ties between the vampires and me were gone. Stefan had told me so. I'd known him a long time, 10 years and more. Until this moment, I'd have sworn he wouldn't lie to me. I wanted to be shocked at proof that he'd lied, but he'd spoken in my head a few months ago when I was fighting the vampire Frost, who wanted to take the city from Marsilia. I'd been hoping it was a leftover effect, a glitch, something that wouldn't happen again, so I hadn't talked about it to him or Adam. When nothing else happened, I decided it wasn't worth worrying about. I'd evidently been wrong. Adam heard that second no as well, because he looked at me, his eyes widening. Before he could say anything, though, Stefan was just suddenly there in the kitchen, standing between us and the vampire on the table. There are some powers all vampires have. There are others that only a few gain as they age. Stefan could teleport. As far as I knew, he and Marsilia were the only vampires who could do that. He had gained weight since I saw him just a month or so ago at one of the bad movie nights Kyle and Warren hosted. Not enough to bring him back to where he'd been before Marsilia had nearly broken him, but close. He wore a dark blue t-shirt and faded jeans. Wolf started giggling as Stefan grabbed him by the throat and growled, "Mercy is off the limits." Shivers slid down my spine and my knees weakened. All this time, Stefan had been listening in. Could he call me, too? Make me come to him no matter what I wanted to do? "No, she isn't," Wolf said triumphantly. Stefan's hold on his throat didn't seem to be having any effect on his ability to talk. "She'll never be off limits to you, isn't that right?"
"His tie to her was broken," said Adam.
"It must have been a strong link," said Wolf, hanging limply from Stefan's hands. "It must have been strong if the monster couldn't take it. But then a lot of people underestimate our soldier, our Stefan. Even so, a stronger vampire than Stefan should be able to supersede the blood bond he has with you, Mercy. We could fix that for you. Who would you rather serve, Mercy? Marsilia or me?" Wolf giggled some more. "Stefan?" I asked, wanting Wolf to be wrong about the tie between Stefan and me, but empirical evidence suggested otherwise. Stefan's back was to us. He set Wolf down on the table. Wolf quit laughing as soon as he was free, face abruptly expressionless. He confronted Stefan. "Did you think that I wouldn't tell her? You think to keep her, and that keeps you from rejoining Marsilia, because through you, Marsilia would have access to Mercy." Adam's arms came around me, and he pulled me to him as I absorbed what Wolf had just said, and that Stefan was not protesting. This was why Wolf had insisted we come to his house, because he wanted to confront Stefan. I hadn't missed that Wolf watched me as much as Stefan. He'd also wanted me to attack Stefan for lying to me, to give Stefan no one to turn to, except Marsilia.
"I will not betray her," whispered Stefan, eyes on Adam.
"We know that," Wolf said, but he'd been watching me, not Stefan, when Stefan spoke. Wolf thought Stefan was speaking of Marsilia, but Stefan's eyes had been on Adam. He'd been talking to Adam about me.
"Come, Stefan. With you in the seethe, Marsilia will fight to protect Mercy because she is needed to keep you in line. You have been Marsilia's soldier for 4 centuries and more. Marsilia needs you. You've been hiding your secret bond from the coyote girl. Now that she knows, you have nothing more to hide. Marsilia will give her word that she will not touch the bond you share with Mercy, won't try to claim her for herself, no matter how useful a tame walker would be."
"I will not take that chance," Stefan said.
He raised his head and met my eyes.
"Mercy," he said, "never say yes when Wolf asks if he can bite you. It will open doors you do not want open. I am sorry I didn't tell you the blood bond between us wasn't gone. I didn't want you to know because I knew it would chafe, this tie between us. If the monster couldn't sever it, then the chances are good that neither Wolf nor Marsilia could do it either. Though, as Wolf pointed out, they could probably take the tie from me and tie you to them.
He hesitated, then said,
With you bound to me, Marsilia would not dare kill you, because her actions hurt so many of those I protect. I would kill her, or she would be forced to kill me.
They are sheep, soldier, said Wolf contemptuously. Sheep are for using. He started to raise his hand, and I felt magic gather.
Then Stefan moved, drawing a blade from somewhere and bringing it down over Wolf's hand in a swift overhand chop. Wolf's unattached hand dropped to the floor.
Not on my watch, said Stefan.
Darn it, said Wolf mildly, looking at his severed hand while grasping the maimed limb with the hand that remained useful. He squeezed to slow the bleeding.
Look what you've done. It will take them all day to get the blood off the floor.
How did he lure you here? Stefan asked. I don't listen to you all the time, his voice in my head told me. Wolf called me on the phone 5 minutes ago and told me you were in a trouble.
It was as if he'd picked up just what was bothering me the most, which I guess he had. Not surprisingly, that understanding didn't make me feel any better.
Wolf promised us information, Adam growled, shaking his head as if he'd heard that secondary message from Stefan, too. We need an address.
I'll get it, Stefan promised.
I counted you my friend, Adam said, his voice icy.
I am, said Stefan. We'll speak of this later.
Yes, said Adam, we will. There is one way to cut such a bond.
No, said Stefan sadly. No. I would only take her with me at this point. She accepted the bond willingly, and that makes it a lot stronger than one that is forced on someone. Go now, Adam. Morning is near. I'll come by tomorrow night, and we can talk.
He and Adam stared at each other, Adam with near violence and Stefan with patience. If what he'd said was true, I could almost understand the lies he told me, because he was right. Knowing that we were tied together was going to bother me a lot. I tied the whole pack to a vampire, I said numbly as Adam drove us back to Honey's house.
No, Adam said. He can't use you to influence me. The bonds will not be superseded like that.
He glanced at me, then back at the road, but his hand took mine.
I have your back on this one, love.
I grunted. Adam laughed. I frowned at him and he said,
Sorry, that's my grunt you stole. I've been thinking, and you should have too. If Wolf is right, and I see no reason to doubt that, the tie between you and Stefan has been going on a long time now, and he has never used it, except this once, to protect you.
Twice. He had used it, twice.
Stefan tries to be honorable as his condition allows.
Condition? I said wryly. That makes it sound like he has rabies or distemper.
Rabies has a lot in common with vampirism, said Adam.
I grunted again. He was being too casual about all of this despite the growly interchange he just had with Stefan. You knew, I said. You knew it wasn't gone. Adam was still, then said,
Yes, I've been around a little longer than you, dealt with the vampires more.
He glanced at me, then away.
And I can smell him on you sometimes, just a whiff now and again when I know you haven't seen him in days or weeks.
I thought about that for a while. And you didn't tell me? He shrugged.
What good would that have done? Stefan is more than a little in love with you. You know that, right? It's what makes Marsilia hate you so much. If he had known a way to break it, I think he'd have told you. I know that such things are not easily destroyed, and that if the monster had really held the reins, you'd have been in worse shape when he died.
Adam was right. All that Stefan had done with our link was to help me twice. But Stefan was right, too. Knowing that the tie was still there chafed. Knowing that Adam had known about it and not told me, that chafed me even more. Our lawyer, Ms. Trevelyan, who had told us to call her Jenny, watched the disc Adam had handed to her. It was from camera 2 in the garage.